Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week to talk about all kinds of good things around our kitchen table. This is community radio. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Donald in the Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
We get together here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. Community Radio brings you lots of fine things. And here we are at the beginning of June. Oh, my goodness, there has been a flurry of weddings. Just a flurry, I say.
And more to come.
Yep. This seems to be the season. June is a good time to gather with food and flowers and music and all sorts of rituals and traditions. All that stuff is dusted off. We kind of look at one another and say, oh, this young couple's getting married. Let's do our best.
Yes, all these hopeful things.
Yes. So today on the Donald in the Kitchen, we'll consider weddings. It just so happens that I traveled to Chicago for a wedding this past weekend.
Oh, yes, you went to the big city.
I did. Kind of the country mouse visiting the city folk there. And I do have some tales to tell. And also, we'll revisit an interview from our archives with Beth from Elizabeth's Flower Farm. She is a local grower of
and she does
good
lots
things.
Of weddings. Beautifully, beautifully done flowers.
Yeah, we'll hear about the joy of creating beautiful things. Oh, so Donna, Chicago was quite something, I tell you. I went to a place called Oak Park. Great neighborhoods, and it was
a lot of Frank Lloyd Wright history must have been just gorgeous.
Oh, it was just walking in the neighborhoods was good. A lot of little pocket parks and big buildings. Turn of the last century sort of buildings. Back when big money was being used to make some big homes.
You know, Chicago it's very unique that way because they had a fire, a major fire. When was it? 1879 or something towards the end of the 1800s that took down so much of that real inner core of the city. And then they built it all fresh from that period. And there's beautiful architecture there.
And it's built up in a very livable, densely packed neighborhoods, lots of apartments, big old buildings. And of course, the people with big money could glom on to a whole acre or so. So there's these little pocket parks that are, and on the corner of those pocket parks, there was these great prairie-style architecture mansions. Oh, these mansions. Think about the same time that Downton Abbey was going on. Well, over here, we were doing things, the big lawyers and the railroad barons and Frank Lloyd Wright and other people.
And the lake is beautiful. Oh. I think when you compare it to New York City or Los Angeles, because, you know, we're talking about our big American cities, I think Chicago is quite beautiful and underrated. The usual Midwestern modesty.
Very good.
Yeah.
I had a lovely time walking around. Now, it did rain. Of course, it's June. It
has
Midwest.
To rain or we're in trouble.
It rained and rained. But it did clear up during the day and was able to walk around. I toured a home. I toured a really nice mansion. We just happened to come across a docet, a tour giver there. And we just had the place to ourselves. And we went in. And the place is called Pleasant Home, built by a guy who was a lawyer.
Oh, I love this place.
It was lovely.
I actually cooked food for Carolyn Raffensperger's sister's wedding there about, a few years ago.
Wouldn't you
know?
It's
gorgeous. The kitchen was so fun. I mean, I didn't cook in the kitchen, but mm-hmm. we served from the kitchen. Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, they had their wedding there.
Pleasant
Home. Fun.
What's neat is that Pleasant Home, you'd think they called the place that, but no, it's on the corner of Pleasant Street and Home Street, believe it or not. Very good.
Yeah, it's huge and very lovely with the preservation efforts.
Yes, lovely.
Just elegant. It's kind of, I don't know, what does it say what year was built? It's kind of Art Deco-ish.
Well, it was built in, 1890-something or other, by, in the earliest 20th century, by an architect named George W. Mayer. And he tried, kept very sparse and it was the latest thing. They had, of course, indoor plumbing and first electric lights, and it was all wired up already, and it was really
the kitchen had those big, long sinks, like I have a smaller one in my kitchen, and, marble-topped work surfaces. Oh, it was just elegant. Really.
It was great.
The fireplace, you could have walked into it practically. not in the kitchen, but in the...
Yeah.
Really
beautiful
building. It
was a fun thing to visit, and evidently it's used as a sort of a neighborhood gathering place. They have movies there on the grounds in the summer.
A lot of events.
Yeah, very good. And we happened to be there. We were very lucky because they had just finished the restoration of beautiful stained glass on the front doors. So it was pretty
nice. Yeah, and extraordinary windows and stained glass. Very.
So the wedding. Oh, the wedding! We had a family gathering there. My husband's family's son was marrying someone from the Chicago family, and their wedding was at another mansion, the Elizabeth Cheney Mansion, in the same area. Mm-hmm. It was lovely, and like I said, it rained and rained the night before, but turned out beautiful for the day, and we had a wonderful time. We got to tour
that. It was a garden wedding, right?
Oh, it's a garden wedding.
Boy,
it was beautiful, and although. Even in the invitation, it told people to, now it's going to be outside, so don't wear stiletto heels. Some people did, so a lot of women were kind of like, getting stuck. But because the ground was soft and lovely, and it was good. It was lovely.
But our sensible country mouse knew what to wear.
Well, no, we had good little things there, yeah. We had a lovely cake and lovely catering. I always love to watch the caterers. They provided us with good food. There was a lovely cake, and not only the cake that the bride and groom cut, but there was a lovely dessert bar with all kinds of good yummies to go with it. And oh my goodness, there was the bride and groom cocktails, and we just had a wonderful time. And I ran across something we got little gift bags for being there. Thank you for joining us. In that little gift bag, I had never run across this before. Wine in a can. Oh, what do you think, Donna?
And she brought the can in. It's called Alloy Wine Works, Central Coast Chardonnay. It's kind of interesting. Remember the period when screw tops first came out?
Yeah.
And it was considered only the swill was put into kind of thing, like the low-end gallon of Gallo kind of stuff. And then it became much more acceptable. And this looks like, I didn't taste it, but it looks like, this is just their advertising, but it says, made from wine that was sourced from the most unique and unexpected lots, the grapes were hand-harvested and carefully blended to create something that's truly Californian. Well, I suspect this was not cheap swill.
Not bad.
It's Central Coast Chardonnay, and there's some good wines coming from that area, so... We'll have to see if we can find some around town. I want to try.
Wine in a can. Again, very much like that screw top thing. Oh, that wouldn't be any good. It wasn't bad, and I could think that would work quite nice for a summer picnic.
Right. You don't have to carry the weight of the bottle.
Yeah.
Because it won't break. Obviously, you don't want to leave it sitting in the heat, but still. Clever. So we'll have to look and see if any of our local stores are starting to carry some of these things. I have seen also cocktails in cans and things like that.
So thinking of summer picnics, thinking of things going on here, this
is you don't
good.
Have to just have your beer in a can.
Very good.
Now, of course, it's not bubbly, right?
It's
just wine. Yeah.
It was good. Well, it's wine. And I haven't tried the Pinot Noir that is also in a can, but there it sits in my kitchen, and I will get to it eventually.
Well, you'll have to invite me over to taste.
Well, we will.
Okay.
So we enjoyed the Oak Park neighborhood of Chicago. Lots of people eating in these wonderful cafes on the sidewalk. A lot of neighborhood little bistros, and I ran across a lovely butcher shop there called carnivore.
Oh, yes. Butcher shops are quite the thing now. Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. Look like they had some good stuff.
Yeah, we don't really need them in Ames because we have Story City Locker and other local. Mm-hmm. After all,
small
this area is where the meat is coming from that goes to those butcher shops in Chicago.
Very good.
Yep.
Very good. So, we're going to think about weddings. Oh, I had a wonderful time. A lot of work goes into a wedding. Emotions are tense, and perhaps. There's so many details. We talked to Beth from Elizabella's Flower Farm. She's a local grower and arranger of wedding flowers.
Special local bridal flower grower and arranger, Beth Kemp from Isabella Flower Farm, and we'll probably get some Bridezilla stories out of her and things like that, but she makes really wonderful, beautiful, unique, all locally grown, right?
All locally grown.
Right.
Yep.
And you can also find her at the Ames Farmers Market on Saturdays
with her bouquets.
So, welcome, Beth.
Hi, it's great to be here. I love being on the Donna Lana Show.
Do you have some June weddings lined up?
I do. So I love doing weddings.
Oh, bless you.
Yeah,
you're one
I
of
do.
These wonderful. Weddings can be such an intense thing, depending on who in the family has decided to take responsibility for the
yes.
event. Now,
yes.
sometimes it is the bride, who can either be very laid back or very rather anxious, or mm-hmm. heaven forbid, sometimes it is a mother or mother-in-law, or people have professional wedding planners now.
Yes, they do. I've actually worked with two brides so far that have had professional wedding planners, and they both say it was a good thing for them. It's a lot of pressure, but I really try to screen my brides and let them know that, you know, I want to be able to create the feel and the look that they want, but that they are not going to be able to kind of micromanage the flowers just because that's how local flowers work. I can't control the weather. I can't control what blooms when. But I can, you know, if you tell me, oh, I want it to feel romantic and antique, you know, I can make that feeling happen with
the
flowers.
Has anyone ever, as a bride, not used the word romantic?
Yes, I have a lot of brides that say casual. They want wildflowers. I think that they find me as a local florist mm-hmm. because they want that sort of garden, wild farm. Oh, I just had an amazing wedding.
Oh, tell. Oh,
yes.
Do tell.
Oh,
do
my
tell.
Gosh.
No names,
so,
but do tell.
Yes. It was actually someone that I met at a party. We played Jenga and drank beer together.
Good start.
Yeah,
good introduction.
Right?
There you
exactly.
go.
Exactly. So I was like, yeah, this chick's pretty cool. Like, I could do her wedding. And she got married at the Mississippi River Museum.
Mm.
Dubuque.
Yes.
It's in Dubuque.
Dubuque.
It's on the
right,
river.
Right, right, right.
It's on the river.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Start, yeah.
It's all about Iowa rivers, the whole museum. It's
oh,
quite
cool.
nice. Yeah, anyway, so she got married there, and her theme was Iowa woodlands.
Ah.
So I was like, this is perfect. So we did a lot of baptisia. Do you know what baptisia is?
No.
It's false indigo, so it's sort of, it's kind of on a long, it's beautiful.
Did you actually have to go out and collect them in the woods?
Oh, I did a little bit of foraging. I love to forage. I picked some false Solomon seal. So
false
we had a
Solomon
lot.
Seal.
So we had a lot of Solomon seal in her bouquet. Solomon seal has a nice like drape.
Yeah,
yeah.
That long.
You can't see my arms, but I'm making a draping motion. So it was beautiful. So it was very.
So where did you get all the
irises.
False indigo?
Oh, I grow all that. Yeah.
Oh, you can grow.
Yeah. So
you can
I.
Grow it.
It's,
okay.
But it's a native.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was trying to use as many native plants as I could, like prairie smoke.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's ready this time of year?
It was pushing it. But she had some in her backyard. But the really cool thing is for the boutonnieres, for the men's sort of little corsages, she had turkey tail mushrooms that she had been growing. And turkey tail mushrooms look kind of what they sound like. They look like turkey tails, like small sort of ridges.
Fan
shaped.
Oh,
it was so fun. I just had the best time.
What did you put with the mushroom?
Oh, so it was. I had kind of the mushroom in the front, and then I had bachelor buttons because I had some bachelor buttons that overwintered from last year. So bachelor buttons, and then I had like one piece of the Solomon seal as sort of the big like green background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I sort of think of the boutonnieres as like tiny arrangements. So I do it the same way with like the three main elements. And then I believe that there was something kind of – I think I had some wax flowers, which are kind of small and frilly. And those I actually purchased. So it wasn't completely local. Mm-hmm. But
oh, really?
It seems like forever brides carry something. Why in the world you would want to be encumbered with a bunch of flowers? One doesn't normally carry flowers, But for a festival, the bride's bouquet is a big deal.
It sort of makes the bride the centerpiece, right? You know, everyone looks at her and she has this beautiful thing that she's carrying.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. And then you deal with, there's a lot to do.
So do you decorate the whole place and everything if they want?
I can do that. I love to do installation kind of work, like making I call them swags. I don't know what you would call them, sort of where you bundle together foliage into a long, almost like a rope, and then put that over the altar and decorate that with flowers. I also have a bride that wants grapevine wreaths in the shape of a heart, interlocking hearts. She has the interlocking – you know, heart wreaths with the flowers in them. So I'm excited about that. I like doing the special things. I like doing those things that, you know, you really wouldn't get if you went to, say, like Hy-Vee Floral. They just wouldn't really be able to do that for you. But I love to just kind of push my limits. You know, like with the turkey tail mushrooms. I got them and I was like, how the heck do I attach these to the boutonniere? We ended up using silicone caulking.
Yeah,
it worked perfectly. So like the stuff that you would seal your bathroom with.
Well, it's kind of a guy thing. Well, see.
It works great.
There's all of this flower technology. So it's not just about all the romantic stuff. You have to get flowers and decorations to actually get there on time and last through the ceremony.
There's a lot to know. I feel like that's the main difference. So I used to do vegetables. You guys know this. I started the farm as a vegetable farm. And when I transitioned to the flowers, I realized there's so much to learn because, you know, starting just from the ground, there's so many different varieties of flowers and different families of plants that I work with now rather than, you know, we really only eat maybe from the same five plant families, brassicas and alliums, and, you know, so you kind of get to know them. You get to know the families. But now I have to learn about all these different plants, which is fabulous.
There's do you do a lot of perennials?
Or I do a ton of perennials. Yeah. I love the perennials.
Yeah, me too.
Right? And peonies
start it and forget it.
Exactly. Well, and they just get better over time.
Oh, good. Good. So it's not only just start it and forget it because this is your crop, but once you cut those little things, they all sort of are on their way to dying.
Yes.
So,
and you have to know how to treat each different one differently.
Like Beth brought in this exquisite
poppy
that's kind of, a very light orange.
Peachy
colored.
Very corally
peach. And the interior is dark.
Yeah, it's got a dark black stamen.
Chocolatey. It's just exquisite. So
its name is Princess. Princess Poppy. I didn't name it that. That's the variety name.
Okay. But now, it looks so perfect that at first I thought it was a paper one.
And we would expect better from Beth.
Yeah, I knew it couldn't be. So, and you picked this yesterday. So what did you have to do to this poppy to make it?
So I picked the poppy before it bloomed. So you have to know when to pick things. So it was closed, but it was just starting to crack. It kind of has these protective
the little hairy green bits on the outside.
Yeah, little – I forget what these are called. I know the name.
Okay.
Whatever.
Forget the biology. Yeah. Anyway, those little green hairy things on the outside of the bud.
It's got a protective – when it goes from a pod to being a flower. So when it just started to crack open, you can just see the color. You pick it at that stage, and then I – burn the end with I use a butane torch.
What?
The poppy has a real sticky sap. I mean, it's what they make opium out of.
That's right.
The sap.
Yes, the sap from poppies.
Yes. Oh,
right? Because they grow poppies. Mm-hmm. So it's a really viscous, thick sap. So when you burn the end, you're kind of making the sap, you're you're cleaning off the cut so that the water can be drawn up into the flower. If I didn't cut it, it would get stuck up with the sap, its own sap, uh-huh. and the stem would never be strong like this one is. So you have to know how to treat each flower differently.
That's wonderful.
And you have quite the way with peonies as well.
I love peonies.
Well, me too, but.
So the trick with them is to pick them before they're open. Also, pick them during the marshmallow stage.
Marshmallow stage. Okay.
So that when you go to squeeze its little bud, it's where it's going to bloom, it should feel like a marshmallow.
In other words, not hard.
Not hard, but not open. And then when you cut it at that stage and bring it into the house, it'll bloom in the vase very quickly. Usually it blooms the next day. Yeah, so you kind of want to be able to feel the petals moving under your fingers, but not to be bloomed open. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah.
That's the best point to pick a peony.
That's another one, that the flower head is so big, although I've seen beautiful bouquets out of them. I pick a peony and just cut it off really short and float it in a bowl of water.
Yeah, or my mother used to use those kind of round glass globe things that are open at the top. That's a really lovely, because that does make you totally appreciate that single flower.
Yes.
And you have a storage method for peonies, right?
I almost don't want to give my secret out. No, it's fine. What I do with the peonies, I pick them at that marshmallow stage, like I was telling you, mm-hmm. and then I bundle them into bundles of a dozen or 10, and I wrap them in newspaper, and I put these wrapped newspaper bundles, so they're not in any water. And I put them into a plastic bag, and I put them into my cooler at a very cold temperature.
Just above freezing.
Yep, like 34 is pretty good.
Oh, wow.
And you wouldn't want to really do this in your home refrigerator, because the ethylene gas from the other food that's in your fridge, from your lettuce and your collard greens and all the other yummy things you have in your fridge, starts to break down mm-hmm. the flower. The ethylene gas will make them mature. But anyway, so I keep them in a cooler that
separate.
Has no food.
Uh-huh.
Yep, separate. And then after about 3 weeks, I take them out and I recut the stems, and they look real floppy. You put them in water and they bloom and they're gorgeous.
And is there a particular tool that you cut all your stems with, or any stems? Or
I have florist scissors,
uh-huh.
Which are kind of just like garden shears. So they're just real comfortable in your hand. Uh-huh. That's what I use. And uh-huh. you just want to keep them clean and sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Sharp is good.
That's great.
Now, what about those flowers that, like, I had heard, for example, with lilacs and woody mm-hmm. stems, you're supposed to pound the stem so that it takes more water because it has a larger surface area?
I've heard a lot of debate about that. I'm not sure if they really know the best way. I feel like every florist has their own opinion about that. I personally don't do that, and I haven't seen any difference. The trick, I feel, with the woody stems is to get them immediately in water and to never let them be out of water, because once they pull up any air bubbles into their stems, that's when they really start to go downhill, I think.
Goodness.
That's
mm-hmm.
my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And then when you have all this beautiful stuff up and ready to go, delivered to the site, some brides, some wedding planners have things in nice air-conditioned halls. Others have mm-hmm. them in really strange, very hot and windy locations.
Mm-hmm.
Weddings can happen any place. Mm-hmm. What is the shelf life or wedding life of a bouquet or of these things that happen?
I mean, it completely depends on the flowers,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If you use something like carnations, can't kill those. You can't. I know. You can have carnations sitting in your car for weeks and they look perfect.
They look a good car flower. Okay.
Yeah, very good car flower. and other things are more delicate. So it depends on the flowers. So I have to kind of pool all of my knowledge in and use it in those circumstances, like when they tell me where they're going to be and what they want, and then I kind of have to go out to my farm and pick what I know will last in their bouquet. So there's some things that are beautiful, but that really just wouldn't work in a bouquet.
What do you do with irises? They are the most, I think, fleeting of all. Do you just not use them?
No, I do use them. They're great.
So gorgeous.
In fact, that wedding I was telling you about with the turkey tail mushrooms, she had tons of irises in her bouquet. I put them. I arrange them while they're still closed, and then you let them bloom in the bouquet. So you'll start to see them sort of swelling, uh-huh. and then you kind of have to imagine in your mind what the flower is going to look like when it blooms, so that you give it enough space. Because otherwise, if you just bundled them close, right. they would be all scrunched up. You just sort of have to, in your mind's eye, imagine how they'd look
so
when they bloomed.
You must make them absolutely only the day before.
I've been known to arrange for weddings on Wednesdays and keep everything in my cooler.
Amazing.
Because I get to cut things.
Must be the magic cooler.
It is a great cooler. Yeah, I bought it from an old ice cream shop.
Yeah. Good karma. Good
yeah,
karma.
Exactly. Good. Yeah.
You're listening to KHOI 89.1, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. We are back in the kitchen. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about the joy of weddings. It's June weddings. We're here to consider all those nice young folks that get together to say, we do, and the people gather around them. I'd like to talk a little bit about music for weddings. I get hired occasionally by brides and wedding planners, and We hold a dance, conferences and squares, and we do brides' marches and all that sort of thing. The old-fashioned get-together and dance to have a wedding. Yes, we
and
do.
And Lana is the dance caller.
She
manages the crowd.
Yeah, I'm kind of the wedding planner of families getting together to connect up families in a big circle. It's kind of a shock for some of them, I tell you. Oh, my goodness, holding hands with somebody brand new. But there is nothing like a good circle dance or just a real simple country dance to get people to get to know each other. It's a good way to meld.
It's a bonding experience.
It is, bonding experience. And the bride and groom's waltz has always been a very important part of the wedding, to even people that don't necessarily dance. There's usually a bride and groom's waltz. It kind of starts off the evening, and then usually the bride and groom break apart and include grandmothers and fathers and mothers, and everybody kind of gets to join in on the dance. It's a way to honor the elders, to again kind of make that union of two people happen. It's nice to have wedding music. Fine thing to do. We're going to go back to more talking with Beth about...
Beth Wilbur.
Yeah, Beth Wilbur. With her experience in making weddings beautiful. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking in the Donna Lana Kitchen today about weddings and wedding flowers, things that make our festivals and our weddings in particular a special thing. That was a fine waltz. A lot of waltzes are played at weddings. That was the Sunday River Waltz by the Barn Owl Band. Flowers, flowers, flowers. You're going to talk about, you talked about the, you have a cooler, but you also have a hothouse. Tell us about that.
So it's, I call it the hoop house. Ah. And it's basically a large, if you imagine a large greenhouse, but instead of it being made with glass, it's covered in a thick plastic, a thick clear plastic. And I don't have any heating in there. It's all solar heated. And it basically allows me to grow things as if I was living in Missouri. It gives us one extra zone.
Season extension.
Season yeah. extension, exactly. And also it's the added benefit if it doesn't rain in there.
Good idea.
Yeah, so a lot of the flowers.
Oh, the petals are probably
yes,
much happier.
Exactly. Yeah, so the flowers tend to get larger, and their stems are much stronger because they're not being beat around by the wind. They get taller, so which I like. I mm-hmm, like the tall mm-hmm. stems. Gives you a lot of flexibility mm-hmm, with what mm-hmm. you do with them. Yeah, it's a really wonderful tool that I have in my grower toolkit, you know, to be able to get as many different kinds of flowers as you can for all the different times of the season. Yeah.
How long do you work with a bride to come up? Do you need some lead time for this?
Yes. I don't.
Don't they plan these things for months and months? Years.
I feel like I get both kinds of brides. I get the brides that go, "Ooh, darn it, I do want flowers," kind of at the last minute. You know, my wedding's next month. Can you help me? And I usually can, depending on if I have the dates available. But yeah, I like to meet with the brides about a year ahead of time and talk about what they're planning, and then we meet again, or we have a phone call.
Do grooms get any input into this?
Do who?
Grooms?
I have a few meetings I've had with grooms. Grooms tend to not have a lot of opinions about flowers.
as it has ever been thus. I don't know why.
I don't know if men are just socialized that way or if they just really don't care. But the worst combo is when the brides come with their mothers. I have
it's
to
hard.
Say.
It's hard. Yeah, well, there's a lot of expectations.
Yes,
there.
I feel like I have to put on my therapist hat to, you know, help us get through the meetings. Because a lot of things bubble up when you're planning a wedding. I know with my wedding, it was very low-key, very casual. We had a potluck at the farm. But I got into a huge disagreement with my mother over the tablecloths.
Now, isn't
yes.
that something to fight to the death about?
Exactly. Yes, we did not need to fight about that. I mean, it just happens. There's a lot of stress.
What, she just wanted something different from?
Yeah, I wanted to put a craft paper so people could color on the tables, and she didn't think that was practical. But she ended up winning in the end. We had white tablecloths. Uh-huh. It was fine.
Well, the idea of tossing the bouquet, there's a lot of archaic stuff that happens at a wedding, as in giving the bride away.
Yes.
And the garter thing, and oh, heaven knows, whole sort
something
of jazz.
Something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.
Yeah, there you
right.
do it.
Yeah. Well, we have to hold on just to kind of traditions, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Makes, some of them, especially yeah. the least meaningful ones, that
exactly.
can possibly offend anyone, right?
Because I feel like at this point, we're not even sure why we're doing these things.
Well, it was the, if you throw the bouquet over your shoulder, and all of the unmarried young women were supposed to scramble for it.
Right.
Whoever catches the bouquet is the next one in line to get married. But it always ends up being your little four-year-old cousin that catches
yeah.
it. I don't know. But the pleasure is there. People like to see a good tussle, I
yeah,
suppose.
Yeah, tossing those beautiful bouquets.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make your bouquet completely tossable.
No, I usually, if they want to do that, usually we have a tossing bouquet, which is
a
smaller version.
You're kidding.
So then they have to buy two bouquets, essentially, you know. If they want the tossing bouquet.
I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they save the other one?
Exactly.
Do they dry them usually?
Often they do, yeah. I usually get emails afterwards asking how to dry them. And it just depends on the flower.
How
you
do
know.
You dry them?
I mean, the easiest is to hang it in a dark corner upside down.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easiest. And then just see what happens.
Yeah, you were talking about flowers are so pleasant. And Donna, you were saying that food for a wedding is pleasant because it's consumed. It's not.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Not.
Beth and I were both saying our art forms do not have to be stored or
nope.
displayed other than in the moment, yes, and boom, it's gone.
Exactly.
Never to be exactly recreated again.
Which is the beautiful thing, is it's kind of ephemeral. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. Like you
very
ephemeral.
Yeah, right. Oopsie, it could be not good for consumption at some point.
Yeah, but it's only one meal or it's only one arrangement that sort of is a catastrophe. It's not this, you know, like if you're a painter or work with some other materials that are permanent, you're always going to be see those mistakes. And I feel like neither Donna and I are really perfectionists. Is that true? I don't feel like I'm a perfectionist.
Oh, good heavens. I always say that the mark of a really professional chef is not that you don't make mistakes, but that you know immediately how to fix them.
Mm.
Donna, you had a – we're talking about keeping weddings and there is a – used to be a tradition of saving a piece of your wedding cake, putting it in the freezer, and having it on your first anniversary. I don't remember. I don't think I did that. But some people do that, like save the top part of the cake and put it away and have it.
Yes.
Donna, you have a story that I think kind of tops this whole thing. Have at it,
okay.
Donna.
My mother saved the top layer of the cake. Okay, this was 1968. So somehow it stayed in her attic in the box that she saved it in, you know, the white pastry box. And it was probably, I think, a little 8-inch diameter type of thing, you know, the usual white, sugary. I do still have the bell that decorated it.
But see, you do save.
But the cake itself was saved for, I'm guessing, 30 years. Probably.
No, probably.
And it did not emerge. My mother, it went through two moves with my mother. And by the time she was ready to move the third time, she said, you know, really, dear, this should be with you.
Oh, thank you,
and
Mom.
I went, oh, okay. So I carried it on the airplane from Virginia, this thing, which was at this point crumbled sugar, basically. You know, it looked pretty – it was interesting. It evoked a lot of memories. And, you know, then there was the wedding, the napkins, Donna and Albinus under it. And I, you know, had a moment. I dug a hole in the ground and I buried it.
Yeah.
I mean
– closure, baby.
Oh, well, it was, you know, some things are just not meant to be kept that long. But, you know, I still have my dress, my shoes, and the bell from the top of the wedding cake.
See?
And, of course, the photo.
Yes.
We do save things. Weddings are a big deal, even though we were discussing earlier, some of them are ephemeral, like the flowers. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Was a little tune. Actually, I thought it was quite appropriate for this subject. It's called The Laughing Vicar. It happens. Yeah, there you go. Well, yeah, one of those lovely English country dance tunes. We're talking weddings. We've been talking flowers with Beth Wilbur. And you, too, can visit the Donna Lana Kitchen archives and go to whatever. There's lots there. Go to khoifm.org and find the Donna Lana Kitchen page. Find recipes, find past shows. We have a good time doing this. And we have some items from our news department. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-a-tick. That's the Donna Lana Kitchen ticker tape. Take it away, Donna.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we have a little bit of bummer news. And then we have some policy wonkish stuff. So the unhappy news was, of course, the
Death by Suicide, How Depressing, of Anthony Bourdain. And I do want to say that, you know, in the last 20 or more years with the rise of food television and all of its manifestations, Anthony Bourdain is the only person that I consider was not an egomaniac and was not it wasn't food porn. What he did for all of us was really cultural. He traveled a lot of places. He explained a lot of different cuisines in a very respectful and interesting, fabulous way. So the food television world, he was the pinnacle, in my opinion. You know, I'm really over all of these big chefs. It's not ever been my thing, and the competitions and, you know, that sort of thing. It's those things I call those food porn because they are not really relevant to most of our lives. But Anthony Bourdain was really special. He was an educator and a cultural translator, and it was sad and shocking. So that's that news. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, this is very policy wonkish. And in our last two shows ago, we had Kamyar and Cheyenne from UNI talk about scientist Charles Binbrook, who recently did a tour of Iowa, talking about pesticide uses and the impacts on health of all Iowans, and things that we need to be aware of because we are in the belly of the beast of all of this. So that show by Kamyar explained a lot of what Dr. Binbrook was talking about. And then last week we announced the news that, of course, Bayer has bought out Monsanto, and they dropped the name Monsanto. So the name Monsanto is no more. So Dr. Binbrook took the time to write to me his opinions about kind of Bayer, which is a German pharmaceutical company, in taking over this large agricultural entity of Monsanto, and why they dropped the name of Monsanto. This is not normal. Usually a well-branded product like that, it's an advantage to keep the name. However, they took the unusual step of eliminating that name, and I think for very sound reasons, because there's a lot of negativity associated with that. And they did some public relations statements that indicate that maybe they are going to try to counter some of the egregious things done by Monsanto. So Dr. Binbrook, he sent this little paper out, the new Bayer acid test, for those working to encourage Bayer to make a clean break from the corporate behavior, marketing, and stewardship policies and ethics of Monsanto. Here are 9 concrete actions the new Bayer could announce. So here's, he says, half of the steps fall safely into the no-brainer zone. So I'm going to read these steps that he wrote out. So we will kind of keep watching to see if the new Bayer is still the same old Monsanto. Of course, many of us are quite skeptical, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They are a European company, and Europe has dealt very differently with the United States, where we're doing the wholesale promotion of these large companies. In Europe, they've put the brakes on some things. So I'm going to just go through these things, these 9 steps that we can watch for that Dr. Binbrook thoughtfully elucidated here. The first one is the newer Bayer will phase out globally pre-harvest desiccation use of Roundup and other GBHs would be a huge benefit to consumers. Now, I think a lot of people don't realize that what he's talking about here is not only is glyphosate used as a to kill weeds, it is sprayed on the harvest at the end of the harvest period as to dry the plants out.
Think of grains, bread, cookies,
right.
Flour.
To pull the moisture levels down to where they won't kind of rot in the silos, basically. So this, we don't have to do this. We have other, so it adds one more layer of this pesticide directly to our food system. So that's a big deal. We could easily stop doing that. Of course, they won't sell as much glyphosate, but it would, you know, and there are other ways to dry these crops out. So that would be the first thing to see if they do that. Then the new Bayer will place mandatory weed-resistant management provisions on the labels. This is no big deal. They can put it on the label, how to deal with weed resistant. If you use glyphosate all the time, eventually you will get weed resistance. We do know ways to fix this. So it can go on the label. Three, the new Bayer will commit to fund independent monitoring of the spread of glyphosate resistance weeds and will pledge to quickly augment weed resistant management requirements to any region in the country where they detect it. Good idea. Not that difficult, especially for a company that large, just kind of coordinating it and tracking it and, you know, helping the farmer deal with this. Number four, the new Bayer will pledge and follow through in adding weed resistance management requirements on all 2,4-D and dicamba herbicide labels. Okay. This has been a big issue in the last 3 years where basically Monsanto really, as glyphosate was becoming more, you know, weeds were resistant, they added more herbicides on to fix the problem. So this is called the pesticide treadmill, and it is not a good idea. So we're having all kinds of problems, especially with the 2,4-D, because it drifts very easily and it kills non-targeted. This has made a lot of farmers unhappy. And number five, the new Bayer will cooperate with regulators worldwide, and Chuck puts in parentheses, rather than bully them, to add common sense worker protection requirements on all of its pesticide labels. Hello, no big deal. Let's protect the farmers and the workers that spray this stuff. This is just a little printing that can go on the packaging. Number six, the new Bayer will A, stop systemic harassment of academic and non-industry scientists wanting to conduct independent research and willing to speak openly about their findings, even when the findings are not aligned with the company's view of reality. Okay, this is a big deal. We have a history, a fairly multiple year history, let's say, of, if not some decades, of scientists who are not employed by Monsanto or doing their own research, which is, I think, it's a very important thing to do. We got to double check the work of the people that are making the money off of this. Well, a lot of the scientists who have been doing this work have been harassed, run out of their universities, reduced funding, discredited in a very, very ugly, unfortunate way. So we'll see if Bayer will stop doing that. And B in this number six was to be fully transparent and honest about who and what science they're funding or otherwise influencing. Monsanto has a long history of ghostwriting op-eds and peer-reviewed journal articles. You know, they've been spending a lot on PR that looks like science, but it's really PR. Number seven, the new Bayer will pledge to abide by any worker safety requirements and restrictions on neonics and glyphosate imposed in the EU, where Europe has much stricter standards. But it's possible, why not voluntarily place these standards in all the markets, all worldwide? That would be great. Number eight, the new Bayer will agree to not field test or commercialize gene editing technologies and gene drives without full assessment of the technologies by independent scientists, coupled with open, rigorous government oversight and wide input from those impacted by or concerned over the consequences of these emerging technologies. That's a long thought, but what's happened basically is Monsanto has controlled the research, basically controlled the government agencies that regulate, and kind of shoved it down our throats to be rude about it. If it's such a great technology, they don't need to do that. They can actually be open and we can all discuss it because, you know, we're all eating it without having had these conversations. This is not It's not polite. Okay. And number nine, at last, the new Bayer will pledge not to field test or commercialize genetic engineering technology that renders seeds sterile.
Huh.
That's they were, it's called the Terminator gene. They were putting it into, different seeds. I mean, to their advantage, it's so the farmer can't go out and save his seeds and plant it again, but it's a nasty idea. Seeds are supposed to generate life. And when you start breeding self-destruction into the seed, that's not a nice metaphor. So we have this from Chuck Benbrook, Things to Watch. And, of course, we will be watching and we'll report back to you. And let's be hopeful that the new Bayer is not the old Monsanto. We'll see.
Very good. Thanks for that news update. That's very good.
It's a little wonkish, but I'm happy to wade through this with you. We do need to know.
We need to know these things. This is the stuff that makes up our food sources here. Oh, my goodness. Well, it is summer. There's summer things happening. Ice cream socials, music in the park. Banshell Park is having concerts on Thursday evening. And the Roosevelt neighborhood, their Sunday evening concerts are starting up again. That's really a dandy thing. And farmers markets. Don't forget farmers markets. Also, back to my visit to Chicago. I did stop in a Saturday morning farmers market in Chicago. It was kind of rainy, so they were just setting up there, but lots of stuff. And I talked to the farmers there who have to drive a long ways into the center of Chicago. It was pretty, their tales of getting in and out of traffic were pretty amazing, but there they were. Lots of good stuff. Oh, lots of good stuff, including some really good croissants. And let's just let you know, there's the same old guy there that is in every farmer's market saying, oh, $3 for the, I wouldn't pay $3. Same guy. He's in every farmer's market. So there's one in Chicago, too, complaining about the prices. But it's nice to know that goes on, too. So we've been talking about weddings today. Thanks to Beth Wilbur for talking about flowers and other wedding-y things.
Happy things.
Happy things. You can find her at the Ames Farmers Market. She sells honey, too. She sells honey. Yes, she does.
Oh, I want a quick recipe to share. I've been encouraging Beth to do this, and I'm going to do it myself. Her honey is very light and mild and the perfect base for rose geranium leaves. So I'm going to go right home and do this now. You pick a few leaves. Put them in the honey, let it sit, I don't know, at least a few weeks in a dark place in the cupboard or not. And the flavor of the rose geranium goes into the honey, and it is yummy honey.
Very good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about weddings. We had music by persons of quality. You heard The Jolly Company, The Laughing Vicar, and The Happy Conclusion by the Persons of Quality, and you heard a waltz by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisciantas.
We'd had Engineering by Colin Berzek. Eat good food and enjoy life.